From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. The Texas Gulf Coast has started its long recovery from Harvey. The Caribbean, Florida, and the Southeast U.S. will soon follow suit after Irma. Costs in the many billions to rebuild, to reinvest. This hour, On Point: damage, rebuilding, and charitable giving after Irma. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Can you imagine the bottom line here? Are you chipping in? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Of course, we will all chip in one way or another. Look at the big bills that are going to Washington out of this. But the damage has stretched a long, long way. Here's Jennifer Stevens Cooper, a resident of St. Thomas in the U.S. Virgin Islands, telling CNN she lost everything when Hurricane Irma moved through the Caribbean.
It looks like a bomb has gone off down here in St. Thomas. I lost my house. I lost my car. Everything that I own is gone.
And it went way up north from there. Here's David Begno with CBS in Charleston today.
You had people here in Charleston along the Battery who were prepared for what could have been hurricane force winds. What they got was that storm surge associated with the tide that set a record when it comes to tide. The third highest tide on record. The water came from the Ashley River here and just poured across the Battery. Benches looked like they were sitting in the middle of lakes. People were in boats. Cars could not get through the water. As people tried, they found that they got stuck.
Spared the worst, maybe, but that is a very, very wide and long area hit by Irma. What's it going to cost? Joining me first from New York today is Julia Horowitz, reporter for CNN Money. She's been closely tracking the cost estimates of Harvey and Irma. Julia Horowitz, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
So we heard the governor of Texas not so many days ago talking about needing $150 or $180 billion from Congress to bail out, and that's just one way of looking at the cost of Harvey. What about the cost of Irma? Are there numbers out there at this point, Julia?
There are. They're still early estimates since the flooding is still a big issue throughout the state of Florida. But what we're looking at right now is hundreds of billions of dollars worth of damage. An estimate that came out yesterday from Moody's Analytics puts the cost of damage from Hurricane Irma between $64 billion and $92 billion. Now, if you add in Hurricane Harvey, which they were estimating will cost about $108 billion, that's a total of between $150 billion and $200 billion worth of damage. Now, that's pretty much on par with Hurricane Katrina.
How do they come up with these estimates? I mean, it's still so early days. We haven't even really seen entirely the damage in the Keys yet. There are many areas which have been flooded and inaccessible. How does somebody like Moody's sitting, I don't know, in a skyscraper in New York come up with a number like that?
So they have these big computer models that they use to estimate damages. There's a reason they give the wide range. A lot of these numbers are still coming in. But it's a combination of census data, what they know about insurance rates in a region, that go into these formulas that spit out these numbers.
So what? Census data, meaning we know who lives where, what kind of housing is there, how high the flooding was there, so we can roughly calculate what the damage may have been to businesses and residences in, and zone by zone they add it up?
Exactly.
So we get a number like that. And then there's a number like Governor Abbott in Texas saying maybe $180 billion. How do these numbers fit together?
Well, there's a little bit of a range. You know, there's different numbers that are being put out by government officials, and then private catastrophe modeling firms are putting out estimates of their own. Eventually, the national government will come in, and a division of the Department of Commerce puts out the top line number that will use going forward. So they ultimately said that Hurricane Katrina cost $160 billion. And that's the number that we use now for that storm. In the interim, there's a little bit of movement, especially because we don't know how much will be covered by national flood insurance programs versus how much private insurance will come in and handle. So there's a little bit of leeway at the moment.
Has a number been sent to Congress yet? We heard a lot about it from Harvey. Has there been a number sent from Irma? We need X, Y, or Z. I mean, we saw that first down payment last week of just $8 billion on Harvey for immediate federal investment in recovery and rescue, I guess. Is that happening already with Congress? Is there a tab being sent up from the southeastern U.S.?
The government of Florida is definitely keeping track of those numbers. To my knowledge, there isn't been an official number that's been sent to Congress yet. Right now, Florida Governor Rick Scott is really still in disaster management mode. They're telling people in specific cities throughout Florida what they need to do, whether they can return after a mandatory evacuation. A city like Jacksonville yesterday on the eastern side of Florida was still experiencing up to 4 feet of flooding in some of its roadways because of a storm surge. So we're still in the very early stages of what's going to happen next.
Julia Horowitz, stand by there. In New York, Allison Riley joins us from Washington, professor of civil and environmental engineering at the University of Maryland, College Park, an affiliate with the Center for Disaster Resilience. Allison Riley, thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
What do you make of the cost of this latest storm? You hear the numbers that Julia's putting out there, the numbers people are beginning to tabulate. Do we have a sense of the full cost yet of Irma?
Do we have a sense? No, not yet. We're still going down there trying to figure out and estimate what the disaster, how big it is, how big this disaster is. We can look to previous disasters and understand how much the federal government has spent on those type of disasters. Katrina, we spent nearly $110, $120 billion in disaster recovery. We can look at Sandy. The U.S. government spent nearly $60 billion in disaster recovery for those disasters. So we know it's going to be a large number.
For the federal government, and we know that's not, you know, it doesn't all go to the federal government. Some of this will be paid by insurance companies, and we'll look
Absolutely.
At that. For the federal government, where does the bulk of the cost come? There's the direct action of FEMA, and then you get into the insurance programs, flood insurance in particular. How does this all add up?
Yeah. It's a great question. So first, there'll be this immediate response. So this, to try to get infrastructure back online, this will come through FEMA, mostly through a program titled Public Assistance. And this will get basically nonprofit and publicly owned infrastructure back online. During Hurricane Katrina, that program spent about $8 billion trying to get just infrastructure back online and removing debris. But then money will go likely to HUD to help to rebuild some homes, especially homes that do not have insurance, especially flood insurance. Then the National Flood Insurance Program will come in, see who is insured, and will give payouts. Unfortunately, right now, the National Flood Insurance Program is heavily indebted, $25 billion in debt due primarily to Hurricane Katrina and Hurricane Sandy.
So I'm reading here that the National Flood Insurance Program has only less than $2 billion cash on hand, authority to borrow only $6 billion more, but we're talking about much bigger numbers than that, especially out of Harvey here. Will they be waiting for Congress then to authorize some greater payout?
So we'll have to see what happens. So I was looking at the rates yesterday online, and in Harris County in Houston, only about 15 to 17% of people had flood insurance, so would be covered under the National Flood Insurance Program. So there'll be a lot of people who simply don't have that flood insurance in order to rebuild. What might happen is Congress will authorize HUD, will give money to HUD in order to rebuild these homes. This tends to happen in much larger disasters like Katrina, like Sandy, and probably like Harvey, but we just don't know yet.
Julie Horowitz, what about private insurers and the tab that they may be facing after Harvey and Irma? They checked out of insuring for flood way back after the Mississippi flood in 1927, I'm seeing here. But wind they still cover, and there's all kinds of damage in big storms like these. What kind of tab is the insurance industry looking at?
They haven't put out final numbers yet, but you're exactly right. So the big issue at play here is that private insurers tend to cover wind damage, but not flood damage. And we know there's extensive flooding throughout Florida right now, and private insurers are not going to pick up that tab.
Let's go to Luba in Florida, Hollywood, Florida. Been trying to work with FEMA to get back on everybody's feet down there. Luba, thanks for calling us. You're on the air. Hello, Luba. Can you hear us in stormy Florida? Nope, sounds like we lost Luba there. I got a note from here, though, from Luba saying that the FEMA, registering with FEMA had been such a hassle. They don't have any data service. They don't have any voice service. Had to drive from North Miami Beach all the way to Hollywood just to get a signal. In Luba's neighborhood there, barely have text messages going through. Comcast is down. Checking the state of roads online before driving, laughable. I mean, Allison, things really get tossed up in the air here. It's no joke when a storm of this strength comes through.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It is no joke. It takes time to get these services back online. What FEMA and the local authorities are doing right now is simply emergency response. They're trying to get people who need to still be evacuated or in need of medical assistance, providing them those services. They're trying to get power lines, live wires off so people can go back home. And they need to also make sure that there's simply no gas leaks so we don't have massive fires breaking out. Then we'll start the recovery process, and it takes time. The step one really is to begin this debris removal. There is tremendous amount of debris down there.
Who pays for that, Allison?
Who pays for that? That is the federal government. That comes through public assistance, and that'll be billions of dollars worth of debris removal. That's removing trees from roads. That is removing parts of homes that have been destroyed, also from roads and things that really stymie the recovery process. So we have to get the debris out. Then electric power companies will start to restore power as soon as possible. They're absolutely working around the clock right now. They're also the telecommunications sector. We've heard about a lot of outages down there, people not being able to get cell phone service. That's because of these massive outages. So we're working towards it.
It all costs.
And it costs a lot of money.
Support for this podcast and the following message comes from ZipRecruiter, who understands when you run a business, you've got important decisions to make every day, like hiring. ZipRecruiter makes finding quality candidates simple. With one click at ZipRecruiter.com/OP, you can post your job to 100 leading job sites across the web and manage your candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to hire. Try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/OP.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the cost of Irma and the need after Irma, the damage, the rebuilding, the price tag, and charitable giving, where that's flowing, where that's best placed. Big shindig on television tonight. Lots of stars coming out to raise money for Harvey and now Irma as well. But, of course, it goes on and on beyond that into the many, many billions. Allison Riley is with us. She's a professor at University of Maryland and affiliate with the Center for Disaster Resilience. Julia Horowitz is here, reporter for CNN Money, who's been tracking the cost estimates on Harvey and Irma. You can join us in this hour. What do you see in the pictures out of the Keys, the Virgin Islands, all the way up into Georgia, South Carolina? Can you imagine what it's going to take to tote up all the damage? Does everything get rebuilt the same way, just to sit in the path of the next storm? What's the Fed's job? What's the state's job here? What's your charitable role here? Your role? Our role? Callers, Eric in State College, Pennsylvania. Eric, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. I'm calling because I have a question for your people there. With the residents of Texas and Florida continuing to vote against the thoughts of climate change and enact legislation that tries to stop the theory of climate change even, and the people, continuing to build where rising seas are going to get them and wash their houses away, why should we donate anything to those people? Why should my insurance rates go up because the people keep building in hurricane-prone areas, and why shouldn't they be required to build so that the houses won't be affected by that?
It's a tough posture, Eric, but we get the question. Allison Riley, you deal in disaster resilience. Mm-hmm. I mean, the whole idea with insurance is we're all in it, and then we help each other out. I mean, I guess government support amounts to the same thing in the end through taxes. But mm-hmm. You hear Eric watching from Pennsylvania saying, come on, acknowledge what's happening here or don't expect everybody to chip in to help you out. How does that strike you?
Yeah, there's actually a lot to unpack in what he just mentioned. Before insurance, we have spent, as American people, nearly $550 for every man, woman, and child on just rebuilding in Katrina, rebuilding for Katrina and Sandy. And what the Wow. listener pointed, yeah, and what the listener pointed out correctly is that we know these storms will happen again. They will continue to happen. So when we rebuild, it makes a ton of sense to make sure that we do it in a smart way. We make sure that people don't rebuild in flood zones. And if they are to rebuild in flood zones, we elevate the home. After Sandy, there was some push by the federal government through executive order to make sure that the money for rebuilding homes in Sandy met some minimum criteria when they're in a flood zone. Unfortunately, in about mid-August, that federal order was revoked by executive order by the Trump administration. So all the money that will be funneled through HUD for rebuilding these homes will not have to adhere to higher flood standards.
You're kidding me. What was the rationale for that?
Actually, I don't know. I mean, to some degree, it was to stimulate real estate in, I suppose, flood-prone areas. The executive order was simply one line saying the Federal Flood Management System, the FFMRS, is no longer active and we will not adhere to it anymore. So hopefully Congress will require that all funding for these disasters will have to adhere to some sort of flood standard. I wanted to actually pick up on one other point is that we know that climate change and sea level rise will affect a ton of homes in and across the, not only Florida, but across the United States. I saw yesterday a report by the turn of the century, more than 900,000 homes in Florida will be submerged underwater, given how we project climate change to be. And this isn't only a problem in Florida and Louisiana. I work a lot on the eastern shore of Maryland, for example, and in Dorchester County. By the turn of the century, more than 60% of its land mass will be submerged underwater.
I want to look at the government insurance program, flooding insurance, but Julia, what about private insurers here and their exposure to these areas? Do they just stay in there and raise premiums? Do they raise premiums on everyone across the country when you get the coasts or particular areas in deeper trouble, Julia?
That's a great question, and it's one that private insurers are absolutely going to have to grapple with in the coming weeks and months. After Hurricane Matthew in Florida, or sorry, Hurricane Andrew in 1992, a lot of private insurers did end up leaving the state of Florida. And we know after Hurricane Katrina, a number of insurers pulled out as well. So it would not be unprecedented if we saw private insurance coverage diminish if they think storms will continue to batter a certain region.
I mean, if they stay in, do they? Our caller in Pennsylvania was saying, well, hey, they're going to raise my premiums to pay for what happens on the coast. Is that true?
We're going to have to wait and see. It certainly fits in with the business model as it exists right now.
Yeah, I want to look more at the government flooding program as well, but a call here from Tallahassee, Florida. Bob, on Interstate 10, headed for Tallahassee anyway. Bob, thank you for calling. What do you see there?
Tom, thank you. What's interesting is there is an enormous backup on I-10 all the way to Jacksonville. In fact, parts of I-10 are actually flooded in the Jacksonville area. What is interesting to me, though, is I live in Naples, Florida.
Yeah.
I evacuated 3 days ago, and I drove overnight to go to my brother's home up in Pensacola for obviously safekeeping with my mom and dad.
Yes.
My wife and went the day before. What was interesting, though, and I wanted to present this to your panel, you know, Governor Scott came on to certainly accentuate all of the issues and what they're doing. I think one of the things that was missed, and maybe by the higher authority, was fuel. I saw hundreds of cars stranded on the side of the road as I drove overnight for 11 hours up Route 98 because I-75 was a total parking lot overnight for the evacuation, and so was I-95. But I think one of the things that the FEMA folks and others would probably need to address to the state of Florida, certainly to other states, is the lack of fuel that was in gas stations. There are 280,000 gas stations in the state of Florida, and as I speak to you now through GasBuddy, There's only 18,000 gas stations that have fuel right now. And everybody's heading back, and it was worse coming up. I think the interesting point here, though, to your panel, and I'll stop here, was that needs to be addressed about fuel for the evacuations, which were perfect. They were really well done. Many people got out, but there was no fuel.
Hey, Bob, let me just confirm. Did you say you saw hundreds of cars along the highway out of gas?
Yes, I was on Route 98 and Route 19 on the coastal road because I-75 was a parking lot. And so many people were stranded. In fact, we sat for 1 hour, my Diamond Dad and I, at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
And there was one gas station that had fuel. And the line to get there, because so many people were out of gas, the Walmarts were full of parking lots with people with no fuel. Now, Tom, as I drive on I-10, I'm at mile marker 96. As I drive, there are maybe a dozen cars that have 5-gallon jerry cans strapped to their roof.
Yeah.
And quite honestly, I have 5 jerry cans in the back of my little Hyundai as I speak, just to be safe. But I think that's a very interesting point for your panel.
Definitely.
How do we get fuel? How do we get the appropriate planning and protocol in place for fuel stations in an evacuation process as this, and we'll let them talk to that.
Bob, I appreciate your call off I-10. Thank you very much, and drive safely there. Allison, I guess this comes into resilience territory. If we're in a period where people are going to be evacuating in great numbers, but we saw the problem, how do you get around it? It's just a logistical problem. They've been scrambling every which way with tankers and trucks and military escort, and still...
Yeah, it is a logistical nightmare, to be quite frank. Unfortunately, gas is highly hazardous, and we can't just have extra stored in adjacent to gas stations. So many of them were filled beforehand, except there was extreme demand, and it just could not keep up with the demand. So ports will reopen today, is what I've been reading. So hopefully they'll get fuel back, but it just is. It's just a logistical nightmare. And there's always, after these type of disasters, I just want to point out that FEMA absolutely does a lessons learned, try to figure out how to make this process faster. Part of the reason why gas stations still, some haven't reopened, is because there isn't power for pumping. So you might have, they might have some gasoline, but there isn't electricity yet in order to power those pumps. So part of the problem is a lot of these systems are so basically interconnected, is that without having power, without having telecommunications, it's actually hard to get fuel to these gas stations.
And no easy answer there. Even if it were electric cars, you've got the power grid down for millions.
Exactly. And that's one of the big concerns with electric vehicles. And people are certainly considering that right now.
Bob, I don't know what the answer is there. As long as you've got millions in harm's way who may need to leave when trouble comes and may need some kind of fuel to get out, that's a stumper. Chris in Omaha, Nebraska. Chris, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to go over the definition of wind damage insurance as opposed to flood. When in Florida, the water that was brought in there was by the wind. It wasn't as, here in the heartland where it rains and the water rises, and especially in certain areas, that water was brought in by the tidal wave. And how could an insurance company deny somebody the wind damage because it brought the water there?
You think they're splitting hairs here. Julia, this may be beyond your expertise in insurance, but it is true. Insurance tends to cover wind damage, but not flood damage, which goes to the federal government if you've got it. You hear Chris's point, though. If you've got Irma pushing the water, is that not wind damage?
So you're right. That gets a little bit technical. But there are three major categories of insurance that come into play here. One of them is storm surge insurance, which is, I believe, what our caller is talking about. The winds from the hurricane push the water level up, and then it comes in and causes flooding. So there is a specific type of insurance that would cover that kind of damage that an insurance holder would need to have. There's also inland flooding, which, again, most insurance companies don't tend to cover. And then there's wind damage, which is a separate type of claim. Just talking about the oil problem really quickly as well, one of the big issues at play here is that oil refineries in Texas are still getting back up to speed after after Harvey. So right now, about 13% of the country's refining capacity is still offline, which is making the problem of gas shortages even worse.
That's a major chunk. We're talking about damage and rebuilding, and in a moment, charity after Hurricanes Harvey and Irma. Allison, can we dive back into the National Flood Insurance Program? I mean, reading up on the history of this, after the big Mississippi flood in 27, private insurers pretty much got out of flood insurance. The government came in. But the issue being, with the National Flood Insurance Act back in 68, the government has always subsidized these premiums because they just it was the only way to make it affordable. But now we've got so many people in harm's way, and of course, many of them are not insured at all, but many are. And I'm reading here that the flood program, you know, in a way creates incentives for people to move into flood-prone areas and to invest in them. A huge fraction of their payouts have gone to the same properties over and over again. In a way, they subsidize rebuilding with no incentive to relocate out of flood zones. I think even Donald Trump's resort, Mar-a-Lago, is covered by this, but the premiums don't reflect the actual cost of the insurance. Is that tenable as we look forward?
Yeah, that is a great point. I want to give one statistic that from about a few months ago is that there are 2,310 homes, I believe, that have been damaged and covered by the federal flood insurance program, but have been damaged 10 or more times. So that's in every few years they experience some sort of damage and get a payout.
And we're all paying for that because this is taxpayer subsidized insurance.
Yes, it is. It is absolutely taxpayer subsidized. So homeowners who live in flood zones are required to get a mortgage are supposed to buy flood insurance. So a lot of these areas, flood insurance would simply be too much if it's not subsidized, so homeowners couldn't afford it. So we are reduced premiums in order to have affordability. So that certainly encourages people to live in flood zones, and also knowing that once they will get flooded, that they will get paid out. Over the lifetime of a mortgage, a person in a flood zone, in a 100-year flood zone is what we call it, has a 26% chance of experiencing a flood. So it is a 1 in 4 chance of receiving flood damage during the lifetime of their mortgage. So in 2012, actually after Hurricane Sandy, Congress passed a law saying that we will no longer subsidize these premiums. But unfortunately, floods happen everywhere, and in 2014 they took away that requirement, and so the subsidies came back in.
That is a lot of public vulnerability on behalf of a lot of people vulnerable on coast. Mac is calling from Mexico, Torreon, Mexico. Mac, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. I was wondering why, when they rebuild homes and structures in Texas and Florida, why don't they build them out of cement block instead of the wood frame construction? Here in Mexico, all the homes are built with cement block, and they're very strong houses, and I don't think they would be vulnerable to hurricane winds. They might be vulnerable to flooding, but not to hurricane winds.
Our time is short before the break. Allison, resilience question there. You know, we Americans are accustomed to wood frame homes. Should we be required to go another way in hurricane zones?
That is certainly beyond my area of expertise. I'm not a structural engineer, but I suspect that it has to do with preference, that we were used to wood-framed homes, and also wood-frame homes tend to be slightly cheaper.
Well, yeah, that's great, but now we have to pay for rebuilding
all that.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we absolutely do. And we need, that's why I think it's really important to have some sort of federal level policy in order to understand, so we can have minimal guidelines of how to rebuild in these areas.
You know, Julia, the incentives kick in here. Very often the economies do all right after these storms because there's so much building and so on to bring it back. But are we just bringing it back to see it knocked up and blown over again, Julia?
That is certainly a risk. So what usually happens after a big natural disaster is the regional economy takes a quick hit. So this quarter, we're expecting to see a slight drop in GDP growth. Jobs have already been affected in Texas. We'll likely see the same rise in unemployment claims in Florida. But in the long run, we have insurance payouts, federal aid, get the economy back on track before too long.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the cost of Irma, the need after Irma, the damage, the rebuilding, the price tag, and we will look at charitable giving for victims. You can join us. Can you picture the bottom line on these storms? Harvey, Irma, what's your charitable role here? Have you figured out where and how to give? Did you just send a check for Harvey? Are you ready to send another? And is this the new cycle? Destruction? Rebuild? Donate? Mike in Green Bay, Wisconsin. Mike, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom. This is Mike.
Hey.
My son left Wausau Friday morning at 6 o'clock. He is a lineman for a private contractor, and they drove 2 days to get down there. And they're sitting in Boca Raton in a resort, and he sent me a picture this morning of at least 200 boom trucks sitting in the parking lot ready to go.
Ready to pull trees off downed lines and all the rest, Mike.
Put new poles. They're working their way west. He said everything around the eastern part will be repair, and everything to the west is total rebuild. It's gone, and they work long hours, and they have a dangerous job, but they're all there.
Good man, your son, for getting down there. That is a long way from Wausau, Wisconsin, down to Boca, but ready to do it, and on the site in a truck full of a parking lot full of what, a couple hundred boom trucks in Boca, ready to go. But Florida's going to need it. The damage is just that widespread. I appreciate your call, Mike. Let's get one more here. Kara in Sierra Vista, Arizona. Kara, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
I want to go to say this first. First of all, I have a great deal of sympathy for the people who have suffered from both Harvey and Irma. I am originally from South Louisiana, so I get the hurricane.
You know it.
But I want to remind people something very important. The West is on fire. There are huge fires in Montana, Washington State, Oregon, California. There are fires in New Mexico, Arizona, and Nevada. There is a large amount of agriculture production being wiped out, homes wiped out, animals, people in need,
yeah.
Businesses, towns. And all we hear is how can we help the victims of the hurricanes?
I mean, we hate to play it that way, but I know what you mean. We've all seen the pictures and the video, and we know how widespread it is. And I guess these storms have just been so urgent in the last couple of weeks here, one on top of another, Kara, that the news is all over it. But yes, enormous and number of fires burning in the West. I should say this show is headed west to cover exactly that. Next week, we're headed out to Spokane, Washington, public radio station KPBX out there to look at exactly the problem you're talking about. But just a reminder that it's not only one kind of disaster that we're up against, to have been up against in this summer, and fires very widespread. We will be there and all over that story in just a few days. We've got Julia Horowitz with us from CNN Money, who's been following the cost of Irma and Harvey. Allison Riley with us from the University of Maryland, College Park, who's on it as well. I want to turn to look at the charitable side of this. People really came out on Harvey. Now here's Irma. Last week, there was a series of ads that debuted featuring five living former U.S. presidents, all asking people to donate to the One America appeal for Hurricanes Harvey and now Irma.
Hurricanes and flooding have upended lives and livelihoods.
Across this great country, Americans have answered the call.
That special calling that compels us, when others are down, to step up and do whatever it takes.
America's at her best when, against all odds, we come together and lift each other up.
Please donate to OneAmericaAppeal.org. America needs you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There are Presidents George H.W. Bush, George W. Bush, Bill Clinton, Jimmy Carter, Barack Obama, all saying, let's chip in here for victims of these storms. Stacey Palmer joins us right now from Washington. She is editor of the Chronicle of Philanthropy. And they have been tracking who's giving what, where it's going. I should say we have links at our website, onpointradio.org, to resources where you can learn about what you can do to help on the charitable side here. Stacey Palmer at the Chronicle of Philanthropy, thanks for joining us.
Lovely to be with you.
What have we seen so far in terms of public response, charitable response to Harvey, and maybe it's too soon to say, but Irma?
we're seeing a tremendous amount of generosity, and people are giving in all kinds of ways. Individuals are giving, the very wealthiest people are giving, average Americans are giving, everybody's doing what they can to put money in, and people are being really thoughtful about what they can do and how they can give as smartly as possible. One of the things I've noticed in this disaster is that people are asking a lot of good questions about how will my money do the most good, rather than just writing a check and saying, oh, I don't care about that, I just want to be generous. So we're seeing a lot of smart giving as well as a lot of generous giving.
We've got more coming. I mean, tonight you've got this big telethon on television, Jamie Foxx and Beyonce and Oprah and Blake Shelton, Barbara Streisand, George Clooney, Julia Roberts, Reese Witherspoon. Huge number of stars coming out to raise money out of L.A. and San Antonio. I think George Strait's going to come on, the Grand Ole Opry House, New York's Times Square, chipping in from all over. But what about for ordinary citizens who want to give and who want to be smart givers? What kind of answers are you giving when they say, how can I give here in the way that has the most impact, Stacey?
One of the things to think about is that disasters unfold over a long period of time. So there's that immediate relief effort that has to happen. And obviously, that's what we're seeing right now. But the recovery is going to take a long time. Katrina is still having effect on the New Orleans region. And it certainly took 10 years till we began to see the real signs of recovery. So really beginning to think about the idea that it's not just now, but it's going to be the long term, and thinking about your charitable giving that way. Think about some instant gifts that you might give to a group like the Salvation Army, Catholic Charities, the Red Cross, those kinds of groups that are in there right now. But then think about the other causes that you care about. The people who are most vulnerable are the ones who are affected the most by any of these disasters. They're going to lose their jobs and livelihoods. They're going to need a lot of help. So food banks, for example, are going to be even more important to these kinds of people. Groups that work to get folks jobs, to get them relocated. People who suffered domestic abuse. Think about all of the very neediest people. They need more help than ever, and find those causes.
Well, where does charitable giving come in here? We heard the governor of Texas say they may need $150, $180 billion from the government to bail them out. That sounds like a lot of money already. So what are the chinks in the armor or in the wall that the charitable giving fills in, that the government spending, as big as that is, and that's big, might not cover, Stacey?
Yeah. Charities look after the very neediest and those things that government can't do. They're often more nimble. They have volunteers who can go in and work and figure out what's going on. They can move quickly. They can spend more time on people. They have the experience in many cases. And that's one of the things you want to look for when you're deciding where to give. Has a charity done this before? And what kind of record do they have in helping the very neediest? So there's lots of roles for government, for business, and for charities. They all do different things. And one of the things I think we're going to see as climate change is really affecting the nation is that they're all going to need to learn how to work together better so that there's a really seamless recovery effort.
Allison Riley, when you think about disaster resilience, how big a portion of the resources that it requires is charitable? Is it just marginal? Is it very significant?
You know, those are numbers I just not terribly familiar with. When the federal government and federal intervention tends to be, and in the larger disasters, mm-hmm. one of the main contributors and taxpayers, in the more, unfortunately, moderate disasters that could be a billion plus terms in dollars of losses, the federal government tends to contribute less to those in terms of the overall disaster costs.
I mean, it's funny. These disasters come along. We see how mm-hmm. people are suffering. Everybody wants to pitch in. At the same time, historically, these have sometimes become gravy trains, too, for either mm-hmm. abuse of some of that money that comes in, either through charity or through the government or just in the rebuilding that follows. Jeff in Hartford, Connecticut. Jeff, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm an architect, and I've made a big portion of my living and career on working in hurricane floodplain zone projects, primarily the Outer Banks in North Carolina, where I did a lot of design and construction work on new, I want to say more resort homes, many of which were privately insured. But then also here in Connecticut, the firm that I'm working with has a pretty decent-sized contract with the Connecticut Department of Housing doing Hurricane Sandy rehabilitation and reconstruction work. And I think I definitely think it's I feel conflicted because I make my living doing this work, but I see a lot of, I guess I would call it fraud, waste, and abuse on both sides. The construction costs are extremely high for this type of work. I think a lot of it is more costly than it should be. And then I think the cost to administer these projects is much higher than it should be. And I do think it's a problem that this is taxpayer-funded monies going to these projects.
And are you saying, Jeff, that when they get hit, and it sounds like you've put a bunch of fancy houses on the Outer Banks in North Carolina, and when they get hit, is that when the fraud, waste, and abuse comes in, and how?
Well, I think the privately, I'm not exactly sure, but I think the privately insured projects are paid for differently. But the ones that are coming out of monies that are coming from, say, FEMA, that is public work, and I think that that contractors and homeowners who are getting their houses repaired see that as maybe, even though it's taxpayer money, as money that's not really coming from anybody that they know. So it's easy for a contractor to say, well, I'm going to price this at, you know, and everybody does it. I'm going to bid this at a much higher cost than it should be. Some of it is potentially justified because all of the red tape involved with getting these projects permitted and then approved is becoming more and more difficult and time consuming as, you know, as we learn more type of work.
It's easy to imagine. It's a little painful to think of lots of resort-style houses going up on the Outer Banks, and then some privately insured, but others maybe publicly, and the public paying a kind of gravy train premium on that after the storm, if that's what's happening. I appreciate your call, Jeff. Julia Horowitz, you're thinking about our caller from Connecticut, I guess, or who's made a living building nice homes, it sounds like, on these coasts. Is there a premium? Sort of a beyond, you know, simple economics, or maybe it is just rough economics. When it's post-storm construction, does it end up being more costly to insurers, to the public?
That's the harsh reality of the situation we're facing right now. We have a matrix of public and private actors, and private actors perhaps have a bit more leeway when they're serving these communities that are in such high need to put a sticker price on something that may be a bit higher than what they would normally charge. And it's important to be wary of that type of abuse when we start going about rebuilding. I mentioned earlier that jobs and hiring is likely to go back up as private insurance money comes back into regions devastated by these floods. But that's an externality that we have to look out for, that costs will be too high, that consumers will be shouldering too much of this rebuilding.
Jennifer in Boston. Jennifer, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm calling about relatives I have that live on the Jersey Shore.
Yeah.
And they had one home completely washed away and one home destroyed during Superstorm Sandy. And I'm calling in response to your discussion about giving, how to give, and when it's appropriate and how people feel about it.
Yeah.
I want to say I think it's absolutely criminal for people who live in wealthy areas of our coast, very exclusive areas, who continue to rebuild in areas where man can only lose against nature, to expect the government and private citizens to give, whether it's through taxes or donations, to help them rebuild in these areas.
That is a sentiment that is easy to understand. Allison, is it a fair characterization of what goes on here? Do we have the public rebuilding, you know, swanky second homes on the sea?
It's actually a complicated answer. So the National Flood Insurance Program will insure up to $250,000 of home value and then another $100,000 of assets inside the home. So some of these homes that are swanky along the East Coast
or along the Florida coast. You get down there in southern Naples. You know, all over the place, you got swank.
Absolutely. So beyond that, you know, they have to engage in private insurance. But all along, they have been paying premiums, or they should have been paying premiums for flood insurance. So they have been paying in, knowing that, recognizing that they have property in flood zones.
But those premiums are subsidized by taxpayers in themselves, right, with the National Flood Insurance Program.
Some are certainly subsidized.
They don't really cover the cost of this rebuilding. That's why they're running a deficit.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Wow. It's a pickle. Stacey, yeah, do you have any misgivings, Stacey, about saying to people, chip in here because it's needed?
I think one of the things to focus on is that what charities are doing is really trying to help the most vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And so they're focused on those kinds of needs. So your dollar is going to people who can't help themselves. And those are the kinds of questions you should ask before you give, you know, to make sure that that's where the money is going, not to help those who are most affluent. But we need to remember in disasters that those who are disproportionately affected are already in trouble. They already might not have jobs. They might have addiction problems. They might have mental health problems. They might be old. They might be disabled. So that's where your charitable money can go and can make a tremendous difference. And we should all be compassionate toward those people who, you know, really didn't have any other place to go and are now in a pretty bad predicament.
Well, these are weather events with climate change swirling around and beneath them. They're economic events as well and extremely costly, adding up between these two to maybe the same scale as Hurricane Katrina, by some accounts, maybe even more. That money streaming in from lots of angles as people dry out and begin to look forward in around Houston and the Texas coast and now in Florida. I want to thank all three of you for being with us today. Stacey Palmer at the Chronicle of Philanthropy, thank you very much for joining us, Stacey.
Great to be with you.
Julia Horowitz at CNN Money, coming to us from the Breaking News Desk in New York. Thank you very much, Julia.
Thanks, Tom.
And Allison Riley, Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of Maryland, College Park. Thank you for your time today, Allison.
Thank you, Tom.
Good luck, Florida. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.